You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 5th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, assistant professor in economics and international and public affairs at Columbia University, Suresh Naidu, on Capital Eats the World. Also on the program today, Scandal. The latest round. We're starting to see. It's not so much that if he does this, but if he does that, we're going to have to impeach him. And every joke you could possibly make about what the Republicans would say about this Bergdahl thing is trumped by the fact that they're actually saying it. Not to mention a certain Matt, is it Bender? Binder.
Close.
Vox.com, Gawker.com, Slate, Chris Hayes' show has this Matt Binder, who is collecting the tweets of right-wingers and showing their flip-flops, part of his public shaming Tumblr, goes big time. See if we can talk to him about this later in the program. Also, Scotty B. Dude, we got a Scotty B story today. Walmart strikes yesterday, and effective legislating as a member of the minority. A quick story about Alan Grayson actually passing a shield law almost all by himself, or getting one passed all by himself. And report on privatization, it is in some respects worse than you think when we privatize government services. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we will talk to Suresh Naidu. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Steeter on the Majority Report. And one of the things that I love about this program is that we have the opportunity to take perspectives and to talk to people who normally speak within circles that where there's a shared understanding of terminology and understanding, particularly when in the context of economics, and we can explicate those things for a wider audience. And I include myself as part of that audience. So I want to welcome to the program Suresh Naidu. He is an associate professor in economics and international public affairs at Columbia University. He has a piece in the Jacobin called Capital Eats the World. It is a reaction to the Thomas Piketty's a book, Capital. That's a fair assessment, right, Suresh?
Oh, definitely.
And welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And so let's walk through this. I mean, because, you know, I came to your piece. Well, I read the Jacobin as well, but I also read a piece by Jared Bernstein, who was who pointed to your piece. And it was in the context of how economics right now, or at least mainstream economics, is rather narrow in its perspective, and it's best suited. He has a quote from Thomas Pynchon at the end of his piece, which is, "If they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers." And in some ways, your piece is about asking slightly different questions. So let's talk about this notion. We'll start with the idea that mainstream economics is in some respects captured by a conservative ideology. Let's talk about that to start.
Yeah, so I think this is a public image of economics, and I think it's been set by, like, you know, the economics of 30 years ago, where people like Milton Friedman, like very, very pro free market economists were sort of studying a lot of the public face of economics around policy, and I think it's actually changed a lot in the last 20 years. And I think the public face has not yet caught up to this, but I think mainstream economics is actually the average. So I can actually tell you, when you look at data, so economics, if you look at, like, registered voters, voter registration by economics professors, from California, there's some data that looked at this, that, like, it's 3-1 Democrat to Republican in economics. Now, compare that to political science, which is 6-1, or sociology, which is 44-1, and yes, economics does look like it's right wing, but it still means that there's, you know, 3 Democrats for every Republican. And so,
right, to be fair,
at least within the
right, to be fair, I mean, there's a decent argument that that even Democrats have sort of bought into some sort of more, I guess, right wing conservative perspective when it comes to economics.
I think that's true. I think absolutely that's probably true. But to the extent that economists are, like, you can sort of think that the general American public center politics of the U.S. has moved right. And in some ways within the general consensus of American politics, I don't think economists are particularly conservative.
Okay.
And so I guess it's like, well, if you hold it to sort of maybe a more global perspective of politics, then surely they are conservative. But, I don't think that's, I think, you know, the U.S. is a conservative country.
and one of those things that you point to as an indicator that that some of this heterodoxy, I guess, has moved into mainstream economics is the sort of broader awareness of this idea that capital share has accumulation of the wealth, or I guess of money, has increased around the world.
Yes, and I think that's now been documented in all sorts of ways. And what is now sort of the argument, I mean, for a long time it was, people were really focused on, like, the inequality between, say, college educated workers and say you know, less educated workers, and that inequality has been going up. And in fact, Piketty and Saez sort of documented, you know, one of their famous papers was documenting just how much of this increase just within labor income was going, you know, to the top 1%. But now I think in the last decade, we sort of started to see, like, people document also that there's been not just an increase in wage gaps between the top and the bottom, but there's also a big increase in the share of income going to owners of capital in various forms. And what's, like, more of a debate, and I think we're sort of just starting this debate, is, like, to what extent the inequality of capital ownership has also increased. And so this is sort of where the debate is, and there's papers sort of arguing it has increased, and there's some papers that argue that it hasn't increased.
And let's talk about you mentioned two explanations for this phenomenon that are typically thrown around by economists, are trade and technology. Tease that out for us.
So, I mean, there's basically the idea that, like, the world economy has changed, and it's changed radically in two different ways. One is countries, particularly East Asia, but just kind of the world, that we just had a big reduction in trade barriers, both including trade liberalization and policy, but also just massive improvements in logistics and transportation technology that have enabled capital to, you know, move to where wages are lower. And so you're sort of basically bringing in a lot of the world. You know, the rest of the world was relatively abundant in labor and had less capital. And so when you integrated with the rest of the world, you would see the relative price of labor fall relative to the return on capital. So that's one explanation. The other one is sort of information technologies and computers and robots and all of this technological change, essentially driving down the cost of machines, and so making it more profitable to substitute workers with various kinds of machines, so that we have, instead of bank tellers, we have ATMs, instead of cashiers, we have automated cash checkouts. Those are these two sort of forces that you could argue have definitely hammered American workers relative to the 1960s and 1970s.
And then you also add that there's another explanation as to why we see this phenomenon, and that's political.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's probably not a coincidence that so here's one observation against this idea that technology and trade is sort of the thing going on, is that if you look at the shares of income inequality, where they, like, the top 1% share, where they've really gone up is the Anglophone advanced countries. So if you look at, like, within the developed world, it's like the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK is a big one, that these are sort of the countries that have seen the biggest increase. Well, on the continent, continental Europe, for example, you've seen much less of an increase in income going to the top 1%. But the technology and trade forces have been common to all of these countries. So it suggests that there's actually something else about, like, the way these societies are organized, or the way these economies are organized, is actually telling you whether or not inequality is going up. And part of that explanation is this sort of great right turn that essentially Thatcher and Reagan and their various and the influence that those two had on political ideas and political ideology across these Anglophone countries was part of what enabled a whole set of policies, from taxes to unions to trade, changed a whole suite of policies, and only in these countries that had that sort of ideological change.
This gets to Piketty is because he says that what we're seeing is a structural trend that that doesn't really address. He basically says this is the way that the world works, and to the extent that it hasn't worked that way, it was an aberration. It was what we need to do is accept the way that this is the way the world works, and then do something after the fact to lower inequality, that is a tax across wealth. Whereas if you include this notion that there is this other force, that is that politics, that specific policies that are implemented impact this as well, you have a whole nother suite, basically, of answers to address wealth inequality before the fact, right? And root to it, almost.
Yeah, but let me sort of defend the wealth tax, even though I sort of lots of people have criticized it. I think it's actually I think, like, as a way of framing the debate, it's actually or setting the parameters for what we talk about. It's a really great concept, and partly one of the reasons is that when you start raising taxes, you'll often see that they have effects on the pre-tax payouts. So when you raise taxes on CEOs, you'll then see that they actually get less payment even before the taxes, just because like the companies will adjust their pay packages to take account of the taxes. So there's a way in which taxes also affect even the pre-tax payment. There's another thing, though, which is, I think, the point, which is that there's a whole other set of institutions in the economy that sort of govern how payments are made to owners of capital, from like what kinds of contracts does an economy allow, what kinds of property rights are enforced, to what kinds of corporate finance institutions you have that are actually governing, you know, how much gets paid out in dividends to shareholders, that that are ways of sort of curbing the amount of the social product that gets paid out to owners of capital. And that we should be entertaining a lot of those. But here's the defense of the Piketty's wealth tax, is that the idea is, like, now things are so global that we need to be thinking about solutions like this that operate on a global level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to put this level of and the thing the book does that I really appreciate is that it puts the problem of inequality at the global level. And so that means a lot of these other policies that are floated around need to be things that scale up out of a particular context in order to be effective.
All right, fair enough. And I wasn't necessarily criticizing the tax, but saying essentially that's not the whole story.
Yeah, that's true. That is not the whole story. Yeah.
And so you talk about it's also important to understand suggests to us that there's a better way to think about savings and why capital accumulates. What drives this? Explain that concept.
Well, so it's actually, I think it's more of an opening up or an agenda, because there's no good study that we have about how the savings behavior of people at the truly at the top end of the wealth distribution. I think we just don't know what forces are operating up there. And there's a lot of sort of interaction with financial institutions like private wealth management companies and the institutions of high finance that they offer financial products and services that normal people don't have access to. And so you're going to see that reflected in savings behavior. And I think what's interesting is that, the sort of normal forces that govern why normal people save, which is like saving for the retirement or trying to leave something, it just doesn't, like, there's this really different behavior around savings at the truly top end of the income distribution. And I don't know what those are, and I offered some speculations in that piece. But I think it's one of the things the book opens up is like, well, what theory of private sector savings at the top do we need to actually understand like these dynamics of inequality and growth?
And in other words, I mean, just, you know, why does a billionaire need more money?
Yeah. And maybe they just kind of, you know, they're not actually like doing that much that's active. They're instead like they plow their money into some private wealth management company to take care of it for them. And so, but because of that, they just wind up accumulating a ton of money by it being like very cleverly invested for them.
Right. I mean, maybe the answer is just they need more money just because it's so easy to get it at that point.
Yeah, that's right.
And all right, so let's go. Let's talk about this this notion about the substitutability, I guess, of or I guess the nature of how labor can the dynamic between labor as being sort of substituted as capital or vice versa. In other words, like. That where there's been changes in such a way that, and this gets into the political dynamic, and this is where you have to help me out here. The labor in some way becomes not just something apart from capital, but actually on some level becomes subsumed almost by capital. Am I making sense? Or am I? I'm trying to go into this notion of you say if the problem is just very high substitute of a variety of labor market reforms are taken off the table. In other words,
So basically, this is like if you've got this robot economy. Like remember when I was saying like trade and technology are these sort of two explanations. So if you really think the issue is that the technology is changing so much that it's now very easy to substitute machines for people. Well, then what that means is that you can't really, you know, increase the minimum wage to $15 like Seattle just did because that will just kill so many jobs because it's so easy to replace those workers with machines.
Right.
And so that's what it and basically it's this explanation for what's going on in the world is just that machines are becoming cheaper and they're becoming more easy and we can easily substitute workers with them. Well, then if that's true, then a whole variety of if that's the reason, then that also then takes a bunch of ways of increasing wages. It sort of makes them very counterproductive.
Right.
But I think the evidence is right. That we haven't seen very large minimum employment reductions due to minimum wages, for example. And so it suggests that that's not the whole story.
Right. And you write, it basically misunderstands capital by putting politics outside the production function rather than inside it. Explain to us what that means.
So basically there's the notion in economics of like the aggregate production function, which is just kind of a loose way we have of describing how like an overall economy, how much can it produce given that it's got, you know, so many units of capital and so many units of labor. And then we sort of think about, okay, well, if we can look at an economy with a given amount of capital and a given amount of labor and sort of think about how the returns to capital and labor are distributed. But, and then the problem with that is that when you sort of bury all of the institutional details of how the markets work, how they're constructed, into just this like aggregate production function. And then you start thinking about, well, how do we tax the product of the market and then redistribute it to people?
Right.
You then miss the fact that there's all these ways in which like the economy is structured from the bottom up that in fact already assign benefits differentially to some people. And so when you start having this world, like there's the economy, it's described by this production function. Then we can tax the output of that economy and sort of redistribute it. And that's sort of I think a standard way that we often sort of start to think about these issues of redistribution. But I want to suggest that there's actually a lot of things that happen inside the production function and that are really like about these, the way that corporations are structured in law, the way that, you know, certain institutions are operating in an economy that actually tell us something about how, you know, how capital and labor work, that you sort of miss when you just kind of write down this production function approach.
Right. And that gets back to that.
Make it clear.
Yeah, I think, well, that, I mean, that gets back to that dichotomy between taxing after the fact or sort of dealing with inequality before the fact. Right. I mean,
it's related. Yeah.
And so you then talk about you use this example of a trilemma between it was a historical impossibility to have free labor, abundant land, and an aristocracy simultaneously. In film production, we say you've got a triangle where you can get it fast, cheap, or done well, but you can't have all three.
That's right.
You place yourself somewhere on that triangle. If you want it fast, it's going to be, you're either going to have to sacrifice cheapness, you're going to have to throw money at it, or it's just not going to be done well. You can't have all three simultaneously. And you say perhaps a similar trilemma exists with abundant robots, dignified employment, and unequal capital ownership. Explain to us what that means.
So it's basically like, imagine that you have an economy where, like, you just have robots that can do any task that people can do, and that they're ridiculously cheap. But then imagine those robots are then owned by like a really small set of the population. And so then there's really not like productive employment for everybody else that doesn't have access to this machine. So it's like, what are they going to do? They're basically have low productivity in the market, and so they're just not going to be able to make very much. And so that's why you can't have dignified employment in that world. Now imagine a world in which you have, but you can have a world in which you have like lots and lots of robots, but they're very equally distributed. So like everyone owns some stuff. Then you can sort of basically will have a world in which people sort of work however much they feel like it, but they get, they're getting a dividend. Everyone's getting a dividend check on the output of their robots. And so, you know, it's a relatively egalitarian ownership, but people are sort of choosing to work however much they want, so you can have like fairly dignified and good paying jobs.
Right. 3 days a week, I send my robot in to do this show. They work with my two robot producers. We're hanging out, and we still members still support the program. And I come in 2 days a week. As long as we all have our own robots, we're all in good shape. But okay.
Exactly. Or you can have no robots, and you sort of like have our economy as it existed in, like, say, the 50s and 60s, where it's like, oh yeah, you know, the robots that you do have are really the capital that you do have is maybe unequally held, but you can't do that much with it, and so there's still like a role for middle class jobs and stuff that can't be replaced with machines, and so those are sort of this way in which you can only have two of these three things.
And so we think about this. You say it helps us approach the question of capital. You write, the capital is a set of property rights entitling bearers to politically protected rights of control, exclusion, transfer, and derived cash flow. Well, explain that to us. And I think to a certain extent, it really is basically saying, both in the political realm, it offers. Well, I mean, you that's pretty explicit. I mean, it. We know from like the work of Martin Gillens and others that money really does win out whenever there's some type of political argument amongst our policymakers. What do you mean by protected rights of control, exclusion, transfer, and derived cash flow?
So it's just that when you've got like let's take a concrete example of a landlord. Like a landlord owns a building. He collects, because he's got this deed that says that he owns the building, that means the courts will enforce his right to collect rent from his tenants. If he can then like, evict his tenants, the courts will enforce that. There's, So there's basically like a set of government-backed privileges that you get when you actually have ownership over something. Or if you own a company, for example, you have rights to fire your workers at will. And so that means you can, like, you know, if you fire the worker, then you can have your security guard quite legally force the worker off the premises. And so these kinds of, like, very, you know, we think of, like, capital in the book. Piketty's book is one of the things about capital is that it's this very abstract thing. But one of the things I was trying to shed light on was that, like, when push comes to shove, it involves the ability to call in somebody with a gun or a stick to kick somebody else off of it.
Right.
And that's the political thing.
Yes. I mean, this is an argument I have with libertarians all the time. Property rights are not enforced by God. They actually the government interferes in the marketplace the moment you establish really any type of property rights, and it's backed up by something other than the fact that you have a bigger stick than the guy who's trying to infringe upon it. And that spreads throughout the, you know, property rights, as in this is my piece of land or this is my iPod, all the way to, you know, your right to even be on these premises and the way that the employer dictates to the employee.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. I mean, I think the more reasonable libertarians sort of recognize this and instead advocate for like a night watchman state. But then the real crazy libertarians, they go after the, like, no state. But those also tend to be the people that think that, like, Somalia is, like, the libertarian paradise because, you know.
Yeah, I don't run into too many of the former. I seem to attract all the latter ones. But but be that as it may, I mean, you talk about to move on, you talk about an example of how – Piketty points out that German shares in companies are underpriced. And this is indicative of how politics implicates capital. Explain that to us.
Yeah, so Germany has a stakeholder model, right? So it's like it means that whenever decisions are being made that are like really big decisions on the firm level, there's a bunch of people that are not shareholders that have the say in how that decision gets made. So you have a work council and that the workers have representation on, and they have like an enforced right to have some votes over what the company does. So what that means is that being a shareholder does not entitle you to like complete control over what the company does. And so that's one reason why in the book, I think it's a really perceptive sort of story, is that shares, part of the value of a share is the right of control that it gives you in the company. And in Germany, that right of control is like, it's restrained a bit by the stakeholder model. And so that's why shares are not worth that much, are not priced as highly as they are in the U.S., which offers an incredible amount of protection to shareholders, to minority shareholders, and basically make sure that shareholders are very, very privileged in the corporate corporate governance.
And this takes us to your point, which I think, you know, really, I think it starts to bring it home, which is that you write that the everyday encounter most people have with accumulated wealth is not through the prices in the market for shoes or society pages, but instead in the control and threats inflicted by their employers, landlords, and bankers. In other words, there is just a tremendous amount of bargaining power that one has, and it's a coercive power when one owns the means of production, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a sort of way of thinking about it that's like there's certain kinds of transactions where that are distinctly asymmetric. A word that I got taught in graduate school was like contested exchange. that these are like markets that where one side, you know, either has some information that the other side doesn't have. And so they're really basically asymmetric. And
that's Stiglitz, right? I mean, that's what Stiglitz got his Nobel Prize for, essentially, right?
That's one of the things Stiglitz got his Nobel Prize for was this, exactly that. It was this idea that, like, you know, employers need to be able to threaten workers with unemployment in order to get them to do any work on the job.
Right.
And so when you then have sort of a massive amount of wealth inequality, you're going to get that many more people that sort of have no choice but to take a job. They don't have any wealth. And so you're going to get that many more people that have to take orders, that have to, in a lot of ways, I think it's so much more general than just like working on the job, right? Like things like, do you have to put up with sexual harassment? Do you have to put up with like a racist manager? Like all of these little acts of minor tyranny that happen at the workplace become that much worse when you don't have good outside options. And so one of the consequences of inequality is just that like people have to live in either, you know, housing experiences or work experiences that just kind of are that much more dictatorial. And so that's what I meant. Like there's a million mini dictatorships in operating in the market, and it's that much worse when you have a lot of inequality.
Right. So it's not just a question of there's a broader sort of political influence, but there it's almost a day to day when you have high unemployment, the inequality is not just and when you have wealth aggregating in the hands of few, it's not just a question they have more political influence, but they have more fundamental influence on your daily life on some level.
Yes, exactly.
And you write, in a thoroughly marketized world, the wealthy can purchase educational reform, the charity of their choice, think tanks, legislative language, and the faceless task rabbiters willing to work for a pittance. And so it shows that the implications of this wealth disparity are far greater than it perhaps sort of influencing the broader economic trends or even the broader political trends. Explain this. When every action can have a pecuniary reward attached to it, and every source of well-being can be priced exactly at a person's willingness to pay, the social power commanded by the rich is magnified in a way that is difficult to see when comparing a dollar in 1920 with a dollar today. So explain what you mean there.
So I mean, part of my professional life is as an economic historian. So I'm very sympathetic to like the challenges of constructing meaningful data over very long periods of time. But what's interesting about it is that basically we're now particularly in the U.S., we're in a society where like so much of the things we need are supplied to us on markets. And so that basically what I was trying to say there was that there's this very nasty complementarity between like a market society and a high income inequality world, because when so much of society of what people need is provided on markets and you've got this really unequal distribution of income, then that means that more and more of those sort of basic things that people need are going to be super skewly distributed.
And so give us an example from like 1920 as healthcare. Opposed to today.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's actually easier to think in a cross-country context than an over-time context. So
okay.
If you could just consider the Scandinavian countries, or like Sweden actually has a remarkably high concentration of wealth. The Wallenberg family owns a ton of Sweden. But one of the things that Swedish society has done is just taken a ton of the basic things that people need and taken it off the market. So you get government-funded schooling, healthcare, childcare, housing if you want it. And so there's basically, you know, the tie between the market distribution of income and what you actually get as part of, you know, what you need is much weaker in a lot of the Scandinavian countries than it is, say, in the U.S.
So there's far fewer facets of your life that are influenced by the wealth inequality, because that just doesn't play
just less
out.
Of it is, yeah, less of it is provided on markets.
And so as we get into a more marketized society, the implications of wealth inequality become that much more problematic and oppressive on some level, because we're just dealing with it in more realms of our life.
Yep.
And so let's talk just ultimately about this notion about what there's one other thing I want to touch on before we get on to that sort of like you ask at the end about how to do better when we think about let's do this. You basically have addressed Piketty to talk about how we can think about these things and model these things better when we are aware of the implications of politics within the that sort of the responses to wealth inequality. And you say the first step could be a multi-sector model with both productive sector and an extractive rent-seeking outlet for investment. So that the basically what you're talking about is let's look at capital both in the forms capital accumulation, both in the forms that are sort of more socially productive and are shared in a broader way, versus sort of activities that are more like gambling, where the dealer doesn't do better if I do better at the table.
Yeah, so I want to sort of suggest that like there's the reason I didn't particularly name finance as the gambling sector as the alternative is that I think like there's lots of different stories, and you know, when you're thinking about particularly capital over, you know, 300 years, then there's lots of different ways in which capital can do this function of like not really being productive but more being an input to a mechanism for transferring resources from one group to another. And finance, you could, you know, some people could argue finance is one of those mechanisms. You know, a classic Marxism view would have that no, it's the labor market, that's what capital can by operating in the labor market can extract surplus from workers and transfer that to the owners of capital, and that's not productive. Or you could have a libertarian view that suggests that actually that one of the things that that capital can be done, it can be used to capture the government, and then that will be used to then transfer resources from one group to another. So I think I want to just be a little bit more general than any particular sector, but just be like, there's lots of ways in which you can convert like a dollar of savings into generating a positive rate of return, not by being productive, but by instead being some method of like extraction.
And so what would be included in that? If not just finance on some level.
Yeah, it's not just finance. Let me give you an example from a developing country, so Chile. So Chile in the 1950s, you know, landowners have lots and lots of power, so the price of land is quite high. But one of the things that the landowners also have is that because there's no secret ballot, they can take their sharecroppers and they take them to the election booth and they tell them how to vote. And so they're able to essentially also buy a mechanism for winning elections by owning land. And so what happens though when Chile passes a secret ballot is that landowners lose their ability to control the votes of their sharecroppers. And so, but then what's really interesting is that the price of land actually falls because of that. Because one of the things that land was capitalizing was not just the productive value of the land, it was the ability to control the votes of your sharecroppers. And so that's like a function of capital land here that is not just about its ability to be productive, uh-huh. but it's about its ability to control politics.
Interesting.
And so we can just think that there's like a variety of mechanisms like that. And so I'm deliberately going far out of the orbit of the U.S. just to give you a sense of like how diverse the mechanisms are that capital can be used to do an extractive function rather than a productive function.
And so it would so the this model, or explain to us what that model then is that you need to be able to sort of include the value, that sort of extra value of capital, insofar as how it also has the ability to control yeah, different aspects of society.
Yeah, that it's not, or think about it rather as just like being a way to capture revenue produced by other people and transfer it to yourself. And you can do that through politics, you can do that through the labor market, you can do that through the financial markets, but that there's a whole bunch of mechanisms for doing that. And that's one reason why the rate of return on capital is potentially very disanchored from the rate of return, from the rate of growth of the productive economy, is that you have all of these non-productive outlets for it. And that's maybe one way to think about the sort of one of the central claims in the Capital in the 21st Century book is this disassociation between the rate of return on wealth and the productivity of the economy. And I think if you allow for this capital to have this like extractive function, that's one way you can explain that sort of pattern.
And then you get us to the point where, you know, it's important this awareness that there's this extra a value to capital beyond what it actually produces or it could produce for society is sort of putting a wedge between the actual and warranted rate of profit that capital essentially generates.
Yep.
I think that's a good place to end.
So
I think I figured it out. Thank you very much. and I appreciate the audience indulging me because I think my tendency has been, and I think to see that dynamic in play in the financialization of our economy. And it's much easier and clearer to see that where that is taking place, right? And you'd agree that's part of the story, but that's just, I think the point here is that that's not the whole story.
And that's not necessarily the story over like these 200 years,
right,
of capitalism. It's not clearly that finance is the main source of that over this long, long historical period.
And it may be indicative of one element of it.
That's right.
Suresh Naidu, we will link to your piece in Jacobin at majority.fm so people can go back now with maybe play it, play the podcast in as they're reading the piece. I thank you so much for coming on and sharing this with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks. You know, sometimes I read a piece that I know is important. And I think if you read the piece, when we called him to have him on, he said it was written for an audience that has a little bit of inside knowledge. And I wanted to try and bring that, I wanted to try and tease that out. And so hopefully people got a grasp, because I think this notion of, There seems to be a broader awareness that, you know, there's more to the story than just what we've told and been told in terms of capital. And this dynamic where capital has more power inherently simply because it has accumulated wealth or property, in that Chile example, speaks to, in my mind, what is problematic about libertarianism, because it denies sort of that notion. And I think, like Suresh said, the sort of less crazy libertarians, the ones that I never end up meeting, sort of recognize that problem in the context of capital is influencing our government too much. They call it crony capitalism. I meet those people, but they generally, you know, work for the Koch brothers.
I just got this like mental image in my, like this image in my head where I'm picturing all these libertarians standing up one by one saying, "I'm a true libertarian," like Spartacus. "I'm a true libertarian."
All right. Well, we're going to take a, We're going to take a break, and we've got some... we've got some sound from the Mississippi Republican Senate candidate. I mean, he's going into this runoff, and it's going to get really messy. Apparently, there's already charges, the police are investigating why a couple of McDaniel campaign workers were locked inside sort of like a courthouse where there was polling going on or counting of votes or something's going on. But I can assure you that the Republican Party is basically trying to weigh whether or not they really go full hog, as it were, on McDaniel, or if they're afraid of damaging him for the general election. We will talk about that. We're also hopefully going to get Matt Binder on the phone or talk to him about his much ballyhooed collection of tweets that where right wingers sort of reverse themselves. It's good stuff. And what else do we have?
We have some audio.
Yes, the audio of Rick Perry. He's back. And it's not just because he's figured out that third government agency that he wants to cut. There's a new sheriff who's back in town.
He's more in his wheelhouse on this one.
Yeah, this is awesome. And we'll actually hopefully speak to President Obama and get a response to what Rick Perry has charged. Folks, it is your membership that keeps this show alive, even for the free part. If we had no members, there'd be no free show. When you become a member, we give you an extra 30, 40 minutes, 50 minutes sometimes a day. So please, if you have the financial wherewithal, become a member today at majority.fm. If you can't afford it, we don't want to lock anybody out for financial reasons. Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will work something out with you. As always, I am always behind on the emails in that email box, and obviously with doing two shows a day, I'm even more behind in my emails. But have patience. Bear with us. You can also support this show if you buy crap from Amazon. The least you can do is kick back some of that purchase to us. You will notice no difference. Simply go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through there, and we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. Also, listen to the program on our app at majority.fm. You can pick up the app at majorityapp.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Great company, great coffee. Do it today. Oh, yeah. All right. Matt is really on the ball. He's feeling it. He's feeling his oats.
This is the Jimi Hendrix La Poupée.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be back in just a moment.